Good evening, everybody. This is James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for September 16th, 2021. And recently, as you know, I've been talking about space travel. And right now, Elon Musk is preparing and getting his crew of civilian space astronauts ready to go up in a heavy lift rocket, which is, I think this is wonderful. I mean, they're certainly heavy lift rockets have their place, and I've been very emphatic about this. However, I have always been a proponent of runway to orbit, and this is, I've explained this before, because that big vertical lift rocket, you are pumping out fuel and burning it to directly oppose gravity to bring it straight up. A horribly, horribly inefficient process when you can go. Now, let's just take a 747 and let's just talk about getting that rocket up to 50,000 foot, which you can do with air burning jet engines. So imagine a 747 jet airliner that weighs in at around 900,000 pounds. And so, just for round numbers, I'm going to say with a few modifications, you could put this up to 1,000,000 pounds. So just 1,000,000 pounds, and or with an similar kind of aircraft. So you could get 1,000,000 pounds up to 50,000 feet, no problem, for jet engines and the aerodynamic lift of the wings. Now, the Saturn V rocket, which is still the biggest rocket to date, in terms of lift capability, etc., was a liftoff weight. This is what it weighed at liftoff, fuel, payload, and everything, was about 6 million pounds, 6.3 million to be specific. But the payload, the actual payload that went into orbit, the Apollo complex, which was the reentry vehicle, the spacecraft, the lunar lander, everything else, and this had a total weight of around 260,000 pounds. Now, this is about, say, a little under 30% of the weight of the 747. So I'm just using round numbers here. So if you're like a detail freak, you say, oh, he didn't say it exactly right. This is not the point. The point is I'm using round numbers to illustrate a point here. Comparing the ability of a jet airliner to carry weight up to 50,000 feet. Okay, so the Saturn V then could put into orbit 260,000 pounds. And then eventually some of that weight would be spent when they went into the going off to the moon. And this is the theoretical modeling. I'm not talking about actually going to the moon or not or whatever. I'm just giving these numbers. These are the actual numbers. Okay, so getting up to 50,000 feet. Now, here's the issue. The Saturn V rocket would have spent a majority of its fuel getting up to the 50,000-foot level, and that's a vertical takeoff, heavy lift rocket. And the other issue is here that the 747 could get up to that same altitude, 50,000 feet, with relatively little fuel at all. In fact, once the 747 got up to that altitude, it could go halfway around the world on a tank of gas. In other words, just getting up to 50,000 feet would take it about 15 minutes, and it could do it actually a lot faster. But at that point, the modified 747 could launch a rocket that was probably up to about 60% of its takeoff capacity. So you could have a vehicle then that weighed in at around 600,000 pounds that could launch out of the what I call my space hotel launch system, and then that could go into orbit. And that's about how much would be left of the Saturn V rocket. The fuel burning is tremendous, so you're saving all of this huge amount of fuel. And the other thing is, then the 747 could have a second stage And I'm saying 747 because everybody's familiar with that aircraft. What I'm talking about in actuality would not even look like a 747, but it would have the wings, the tail section, etc. And so you can look on my webpage where I talk about this. And the point is that the heavy lift rocket should have really never been used. We should have always had a runway to orbit capability. And you can make these bigger too. You can make the Russians have a jet aircraft, which is enormous and is capable of getting up to 50,000 feet. And it was, by the way, it was built originally to carry the Russian space shuttle back and forth between locations. That's why it was originally built. It is called the Antonov 225, or AN-225 is its designation. That's the name, like Boeing 747. This is the Antonov 225. It has three engines on each wing, six engines total. It's the biggest transport plane in the world and has a capacity which is twice that of the Saturn V rocket. Has the capability of getting up to 50,000 feet. And there again, the payload, you could set into orbit literally the same as a Saturn V rocket using runway to orbit technology. So I want to just clarify, I said that the payload of the, I'm comparing payloads here, not total weight, I'm comparing payloads. The payload of the AN-225 cargo plane is twice as much cargo capacity as this cargo capacity of the Saturn V rocket, which is around 260,000 pounds. So in the, actually it's more, it's 260,000 kilograms, which is like 2 kilograms per pound. So it's more than twice the capacity, cargo capacity, as the Saturn V rocket. Not total weight. Don't get me wrong. Don't misquote me here. Okay, so what is this telling you? Now, another little fun fact here is that the Saturn V rocket was burning 40,000 pounds of fuel per second. And so that, and then also if it burned for 20 seconds, the first 20-second burn of the Saturn V rocket burned off 800,000 pounds of fuel, and it only got up to an amazing altitude of 500 meters. So it just barely cleared the launch pad. Imagine that, just by a little bit after 20 seconds of burn time, burning up a huge portion of its fuel. So vertical lift rockets, now I've talked about the rocket problem before, and imagine that your astronaut had a big steak supper the night before. And he had an extra pound of payload on the rocket. And you wanted to add extra fuel because the astronaut had eaten a big steak supper the night before. Now you would have to add a tremendous amount of fuel and then the infrastructure to hold that fuel, and then all the extra fuel to lift all of that extra infrastructure and fuel, not just for the steak that happens to be sitting in this guy's stomach being digested. So you can see that these things are very critical, especially when you get up to these very large rockets. Now, the one thing about big rockets is that they're fairly reliable. The Russians have been using them for decades and decades, but once again, this whole operation of setting up a launch pad, the absolutely amazing amount of infrastructure that it takes to house a rocket, then you have the liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen requirements where these are super cooled. This is not just cooled. This is not just like your average refrigerator cooled. These are very cold temperatures that you have to maintain. And then anything that's turning into a vapor form has to bleed off. That's why when you see one of these rockets sitting out on a launch pad, there's a little tube there, and there's this kind of smoke coming out the side. That's the bleeding off the higher temperature portion of the liquid fuel. And that's why the Saturn V was using liquid kerosene, which is liquid at room temperature. And the Russians still use on their big lift rockets that they go up every day, sometimes two or three times per day into space, they're still using kerosene because you don't have all of this infrastructure. Another thing, kind of an interesting thing that the Russians did in their space program, very different from NASA. What NASA would do is they would build the rocket in its vertical position. And the Russians would build the rocket in the horizontal position, and then they had big hydraulic lifts that lifted it up to the vertical position. But it was much easier to build a rocket down at ground level, or relatively close to ground level. These are big, big rockets. But it's something that I happen to have a little bit of experience with myself, with the wing generator. They're on hinged towers. So you have this tremendously heavy steel structure that you're lifting up with hydraulics. And so anyway, that's the way they did it. The Russians built it horizontally, and then they would just raise it up vertically and load it full of fuel, etc. But of course, the loading of the fuel is an important aspect here. Loading the fuel before takeoff and maintaining it. But if you have kerosene, they have trains that come out to the launch sites in Russia. They have trains that come out there that are loaded with the kerosene that go into the rockets. And this is quite a process. I mean, this is they have this down to an art form. But, okay, going back to the idea of vertical launch systems versus runway-to-orbit systems, hands down, the easiest and least amount of infrastructure, because we already have airports, and going up to 50,000 feet is not a big deal. That's about 10 miles up. So at any rate, now I want to introduce a new concept here in this line of thinking that I'm going through right now. What if, because we have jet aircraft with jet fuel basically burning, getting you up to 50,000 feet, but what if we converted this to electric turbos, fan jets, and this is, you see them a lot on model airplanes, but this is becoming more and more common. There are companies out there that are building small private jet aircraft with electric motors and electric batteries in the wings. The battery technology is getting to the point where it's a viable technology, and they're getting to the point where they compete in price and, in, of course, in distance. That's the thing where of course, in an airplane, weight is a major issue. So if your fuel weighs more or your energy source weighs more, then you're not going to be going as far. So the energy density is getting up to the point where it is able to rival the gasoline engines, because you have, and here's the other issue, in the gasoline-burning engines, or petroleum-burning, I should say, engines, you have a lot of weight in the engine, and you don't have that with an electric engine. So even though your batteries don't have the energy density as petroleum fuel, you don't have that massive engine in there. So you now have the ability to recoup some of your weight. You can have heavier batteries and then still come off with the same amount of energy density in the overall system, if you look at the overall airplane, or even if you just look at the batteries and the ducted fans, they're called ducted fans, versus a jet engine with also a ducted fan setup. The commercial jets are a fan jet, which means that the combustion turns a set of rotors, and then those in turn turn the fan blades, and that's where about 90% of the propulsion comes from, is from the fan part of the jet engine, the outer part, not the inner part. In a military jet aircraft, the majority of the thrust comes from direct impulse or direct inertial force from the fuel being burned. And when they're doing maneuvers, etc., they're about 90% of the force comes from burning the fuel and just that fuel coming out the nozzle. It's a commercial jet is, like I was saying, you burn the fuel, that turns a series of blades, which then are geared to the outer fan blades, which are just fan blades, and the air comes around that inner housing and within the ducted fan, and that's a fan jet with petroleum-based fuels. But, okay, so the idea now is, what if you could take something up with electricity and get up to 50,000 feet, and then you have a launch system that can impart a good deal of velocity to the launching vehicle, the hotel tube in this case, or the manufacturing tube, etc., and then the final burn takes it up to orbit. But lightweight is the key here. Lightweight is the key. And if you look at model airplanes, of the type of model airplanes they're building today, they're very, very lightweight. They're very strong, they're very lightweight, and it's the same issue. It's having a system that is, because weight is everything. Whether you have a rocket-type propulsion system, or whether you have jet engines, or whether you have electric ducted fan engines, it all comes down to weight. How do you keep the weight down? And luckily for all of us, these technologies are excellent. Now, I just want to give you a little story here. When I was a little kid, I built an airplane. It was a two-engine. I remember it was a two-engine airplane. And I don't remember exactly. It was back in those days, probably a military engine, a military model. But it was balsa wood, and so you would cut out these little pieces. They were actually pre-cut. You just kind of bend the balsa wood a little bit, and it was a frame, and I had not covered it with paper yet. And so it was, and you know, I remember being fairly young when I did this, so I guess I was already starting out trying to do modeling and that type of thing. But back in those days, the technology was not there. The batteries were big and heavy. The motors did not have much power for the amount of electricity they used. But anyway, be that as it may, this was a rubber band. If you're old enough to remember these, I don't think they make them anymore with rubber band powered propellers. But they would put a rubber band in there, and you would wind up the propeller. And the rubber band would wind and wind and wind, and then you'd get a double wind on the rubber band to get more power. And the rubber band would last for about 10 seconds. And I mean, it was enough to make the airplane fly for, you know, maybe 10 seconds, which was a big deal at that time when you were a little kid. We're talking back in probably the 60s, you know, maybe even the 50s when I was doing this. And so I said, well, I'm going to get some electric motors. So I somehow, with my paper route money or something, I went out and I bought the little electric motors of the day. And they had little two wires coming out. And then I put a little container rack in my airplane. And I put some D batteries. Now, these are the kind that used to go in the big flashlights when we had the incandescent bulbs in the flashlights. And, of course, those were very heavy. They probably weighed, I don't know if they weighed a pound each, but they were pretty heavy. And so I put those in there, and the propellers would turn, but they really didn't have much power. And so they certainly didn't have enough power to fly and make the, even if you gave it a push. And like I should add this also, when you had the propellers that were rubber band powered propellers, you would hold up the airplane and you would kind of get your fingers out there and you'd hold the propellers and you'd give it a thrust. You with both hands, if it was two propellers or one propeller, you would use one hand and maybe one hand on the propeller holding it still and then the other one on the airplane and you'd throw it and let go all at one time. And they would fly, you know, the 10 seconds you could get across the yard. That was pretty interesting to see the airplane flying as something you built. But, you know, not like today. And I was surprised. Oh, it was maybe 25 years ago. I went to the hobby store and I bought a little model airplane. And it was made out of styrofoam. It was a styrofoam mold, and you put the wings in and you put the tail on. And I think the elevator, which is the rear vertical tail, was already part of the whole fuselage, like a cast piece of styrofoam. And this whole thing hardly weighed anything. And it had nice big wings on it and an electric motor and a little battery pack that was rechargeable. And that thing flew around. It was remote control a very simple remote control. And that thing flew around for 20 minutes, and I was just amazed. I was like, man, this thing, you know, this thing flying around for 20 minutes compared to what I did when I was a little kid with the technologies that were available back then. So what happened? The motors got better. The ducted fans were much better, much more efficient than a propeller. And the battery packs held a lot more. The energy density was much, much higher. And so now they're doing like 3D printing of the fuselage, etc. So they're really, really lightweight. So a model airplane does not need a big propeller, and it's got all that lift from the big airframe and a very lightweight. So these things can fly around for a long time. So the model builders today are building these airplanes, very lightweight, a lot of power relative to the weight, the battery packs, etc. But, of course, a lot of the builders are using petroleum-based engines. It's not really, I don't think they're using, they might be using gasoline, but it's like a special fuel for modelers. But the point is that you can simulate large aircraft now. They're building airplanes that are scale models to jetliners and very precise with 3D modeling, etc., computerized 3D printing, various modern techniques of building that were just not even available when I was young, or even some of the techniques not even available 10 years ago. Okay, so anyway, the object is to build things very light. And now when if you're dealing with big things that are very lightweight down in the lower atmosphere here, that's one thing. But if you get up into the upper atmosphere or outer space, then light things are they're very easy to manage. Let's just put it that way. So every pound of weight, or more correctly, every unit of mass, once you get it out into outer space, since you're weightless, you don't have any weight, you have mass. But every unit of mass extra is an expense in terms of managing it, moving it, etc. So today we have the technologies in carbon fiber, in terms of there are people who believe that they will be building space habitats with 3D printing in outer space. And now if you're not familiar with 3D printing, I'll just give you an idea what this is like. You know, a regular printer, you have a print head, and what happens, it's like a little needle in a sense. It's got a hole at the end, and ink comes out, and it a lot of times they're like a sputtering, and there could be a powder. There's various different methods, but the typical one is you have ink cartridge or an ink reservoir. The ink comes through a little tube, and then it creates little dots basically on the page. And then, of course, you have colors, etc. But with 3D printing, what you do is you create a model, which is three-dimensional, and instead of having a print head with ink on it, you have plastic, like a coil of plastic material. And these can take on all different types of shapes and forms and plastic materials, different densities, etc. And what happens is the printhead goes along and basically just builds up the surface very exactly. And part of the 3D modeling is you can put in reinforcements and you can put in other, you know, any details that you want, little indentations, etc. And then when you get all done, you can cut out little pieces of it, like for doors and windows, etc. And then you, the 3D printing, you can make the wings, for example, the aircraft in multiple pieces, and then they glue together. And you can build up this basically 3D model. And people are doing very creative, large-scale RC models, remote-controlled models, using this technique. But where this is going, there are already people building houses with 3D printing, full-size houses. So you set up a device that literally prints the house. And, of course, once you get into outer space, you can do this and have a 3D printer build your habitat and, you know, build the doors in, the windows. And so this is expected to be one of the primary building techniques in outer space. Also carbon fiber. From the very production of carbon fiber, let me just go through a little bit on how you make carbon fiber. What carbon fiber is, it's literally a carbon string. And carbon builds up very strong bonds. That's why diamond is one of the hardest materials. It's made up strictly of carbon in a crystalline form. And but the carbon fiber strands, what they do is they build it up with impurities in it, and then they heat it up to a very high temperature in a vacuum environment. And what happens is all of the impurities are baked off except for the carbon, and the carbon is the only thing left over. And then it's cooled down, and you end up with this pure carbon fiber. And by the way, graphene is another one of those amazing carbon materials that can come off in a single atomic layer. And that has uses in outer space too. But at any rate, in terms of structural buildings or other uses, I'll just put it that way. Okay, and so carbon fiber, then, when you actually mold it, you build a mold, and then you take, it could be mats, it could be a sheet, it could be a woven fiber in like a material, and then you wrap that around a mandrel or around a form. And by the way, I made one of the very first carbon fiber bottles back in the, when I was probably 30 years ago or more. And I had a company that did carbon fiber work. And so anyway, we wound the, it was a long material of carbon fiber, and we wound it around a Coca-Cola bottle. Now, the modern Coca-Cola bottles, if you look at the bottom, this is a 2-liter Coke bottle. And if you look at the base, it has some indentations in it. But back in those days, the Coca-Cola 2-liter bottle had a round base, and then they had a plastic fitting that was on the bottom that was the actual base. But the you could take that off, and you were left with a perfectly, a beautiful cylinder with perfectly spherical ends, and then, of course, the part at the top where the cap screws on formed the nozzle where the Coca-Cola would come out, but the bottom side was a perfect sphere. And so we wound this using it as a mandrel, wound the carbon fiber around that, and then had it baked and processed, and I still have that bottle. And it's the people at the carbon fiber company were amazed. It was like, wow, we can make bottles out of this. And that was the first carbon fiber bottle. Now they're using it for all kinds of, like, if you get a water softener, chances are it's going to have a fiberglass, probably not carbon fiber, but a fiberglass winding that's just that same technique. Okay, so anyway, but in the curing process, there's a resin. So you take the carbon fiber and you wet it so that it's completely saturated with the resin material, which is like a fiberglass type of resin, and then there's hundreds of different types of these resins for different properties, etc. But the carbon fiber is interesting in that its properties, it has a tensile strength, but it has no compressive strength. So, in fact, in the early 1990s, I had an archery business. Yes, I had a business building archery equipment, and I took some of the designs of whether it was at the time it was called traditional archery, longbows and flat bows, and I made models out of carbon fiber. And very interesting, carbon fiber has a little bit of stretch to it, but it has no compressive ability. And on an archery bow, there's when the staves bend, on the inside of the bend you have to have compression strength, and on the outer side you have to have stretching. And that's why woods like, say, for example, yew or red elm or other materials have good stretching and compressive properties. Stretching on the front side of the bow, and then compressibility on the inside of the kerb. And that's, for example, why fiberglass laminated bows that Fred Bear popularized, where you have two pieces of like maple laminate, very thin, glued together, and then you have two pieces of fiberglass on the outside. Amazing, good, very good construction technique, and made mass produce these. But anyway, I'm getting a little bit off topic here, but the fiberglass has both compressibility and tensile strength, but the carbon fiber does not. So there was a technique we used to wrap the fibers from the back side of the bow where you wanted compression, to wrap those fibers around the front side of the bow and translate the tensile strength on the front side into compression on the back side. Very interesting. And then the company that I worked for that actually did that work were making some of the very first carbon fiber golf shafts. And that's why I chose them, is because they had experience in making, using this technique of using a material that only has tensile strength to get both compressive and tensile strength. But the point is that carbon fiber, it doesn't expand with temperature, doesn't shrink with low temperatures. Very stable material. It, when you cure it in a vacuum. You put a vacuum bag around it and then draw the vapor off the plasticizing material in the resin. But you do it in a vacuum. Now, here's the thing about outer space. The process of creating carbon fiber and the process of making the mold and then curing the carbon fiber resin in outer space is much better because you have a perfect vacuum. You don't have to deal with the impurities in the atmosphere when you're dealing with making the carbon fibers, these little teeny carbon fibers. Okay, so at any rate, that's another manufacturing technique, but the end result is very strong, very, very strong composite material, but very lightweight. Interestingly enough, Bert Rutan, of course, was an expert in making airplanes out of carbon fiber, and he made the Long Easies, the canard type of aircraft, and a lot of people could build these at home. So they would take and make a styrofoam model, and also it's a different way of making surfboards. You take a styrofoam mold and you put with the surfboards, it's more fiberglass. But with the airplanes, fiberglass, glass is heavier than carbon. It's not as strong as carbon, so fiberglass is not the material of choice when you're dealing with airplanes. So carbon fiber became the mechanism for building airplanes. Now, and the reason I'm going through all of this is to discuss the techniques for building the runway to orbit, fuselage, the airplanes, the hotels that eventually end up in outer space, etc. But I'm going to make a quick segue here. I was once in a factory that was building the, they were doing piecework for the F, I think it, at the time it was an F-14 fighter, a Navy fighter. And the Delta Wing, the two tails, that's where they started making those high performance, the flat bottom fighters. And at any rate, I was in a factory where they did machining of aluminum. And they would start with a block of aluminum that was huge, a big block of aluminum, and would machine it down to the point where they had a very low weight. And this was the complete frame of this aircraft, of a jet fighter plane. And so it was like I saw the initial blocks, and then I saw the CAD machining, the computer-assisted design machining, and unbelievable the amount of aluminum that was taken off of there to get down to this very strong but very precisely machined piece of aluminum, and that was the base of the aircraft. And then I also watched the transition as they went from that design manufacturing style to carbon fiber. And carbon fiber is more like when you were a little kid and you bought these model airplanes or a model boat or a model car, you'd have little pieces you would put together and glue together. And that's what carbon fiber is like. Now, the what was it? The Mosquito, the in World War II, the aircraft. Who was the manufacturer of that? It was the de Havilland. De Havilland, a British company that came up with this concept. At the beginning of World War II, they needed a long-range fighter plane that was very fast and maneuverable. And it turned out the Mosquito was the answer. They built it out of wood. And from what I remember, they built it out of like balsa wood plywood, so extremely lightweight, extremely strong, had two big Merlin engines in it, counter-rotating. And this was one of the first composite aircraft where they built it on a mold. And the one interesting thing about this in the war effort is that the pieces were made all over the countryside. They would be making pieces in somebody's barn because unlike Germany, which had centralized manufacturing plants for the German aircraft in World War II that the Allies eventually bombed, the English had their manufacturing of the Mosquito, for example, all over the countryside. But anyway, I'm digressing here, excuse me. Okay, so back to the de Havilland Mosquito. It was the first composite aircraft made with wood and resin, so a technique where the fiber came from the wood, and then the resin was used to give it stiffness. So those two properties were used in building the Mosquito aircraft, tremendously strong material. And of course the Mosquito had a velocity up in the 400 mile an hour range, as I recall. And so tremendous stresses on this flying and carrying heavy weights and armament and things like that. But the Mosquito was so fast that it did not carry armament in the traditional sense of steel plates around the engine, etc., because it simply could outrun any enemy aircraft. But anyway, the point is that the Mosquito was the precursor to what they're doing today with carbon fiber. Okay, but once you get out into outer space, it could be that at a certain point in outer space, we no longer are building things on Earth, but we're building them in outer space. So 3D printing and carbon fiber production, carbon fiber manufacturing in outer space may be a viable technique, building technique, in the future. But the whole issue here, once again, comes back to a factor of weight, of mass, keeping the mass down so that the materials you have to take into space, no matter whether you go from a runway or go from a vertical lift rocket, you have the same issue. Every ounce of material, every gram of material that you take up into space is costing you in terms of infrastructure, propellant, the all of the things that are necessary to get materials into outer space. And so the other thing about carbon fiber is that, or printing also, but the other thing that carbon fiber has that printing does not have is it has the element of tensile strength. A good comparison would be cement. A good comparison would be cement, for example, where you have cement is the equivalent of the resin in a construction process. And then the reinforcement, the rebar that goes inside the cement gives it stability, gives it structural stability. And so that's why cement columns and beams and cement structures are very strong, is because it has those two components. It has the like rock-like properties, but then it also has the rebar, which gives it stiffness and rigidity and ultimately a lot of strength. And in the building of carbon fiber, you have the carbon fibers, which give it strength. To the contrary, 3D printing does not have that, and so you depend on the amorphous state of materials in 3D printing to give it strength. And amorphous simply means non-crystalline. That's one other thing about carbon fiber. You could think of it as kind of a cross between a crystalline state and an amorphous state. Amorphous is non-organized, and so an atomic structure that is non-organized, whereas a diamond would be a crystalline state of carbon, and charcoal or coal would be an amorphous form of charcoal, non-organized, non-crystalline. But you can take that amorphous carbon and through processing turn it into a crystalline or a one of the forms of carbon like carbon fiber or graphene, for example, and or into organic chemistry, into hydrocarbons, etc. And that's why hydrocarbons are so useful, because they have the organized carbon in them. Okay, so anyway, I'm getting off on this tangent, but now let's get back to space travel. So when you're building a spacecraft, you want it to be strong, you want it to be able to hold an atmosphere. It's going to be under stresses. It's going to be under bombardment by micrometeorites and small particles. Okay, so now I'm going to diverge just a little bit more, because there are processes in outer space that work much better than manufacturing processes down here on planet Earth. And one of them is dealing with metallurgy. And this is very interesting. Most of the weakness and flaws in metal products on Earth are because of impurities. And it's very hard to get them out of the metal, because when you heat the metal up to a liquid point, to the point where you're going to cast it, that's the typical way that metal is dealt with. And then you make, for example, metal sheeting, which can be rolled into cans, for example, steel or aluminum cans. It can be molded into car doors or car bumpers or rims on tires or any other shape that you want, airframes for airplanes, whatever you want to make out of metal. But the problem with strength is that they have impurities, and also fractures. When the product cools, they can develop fractures. And so that's a big issue, because, for example, an airplane, every part that goes into an airplane is examined with X-ray technology so that you can see internal fractures, because once the plane starts working, tremendous stresses, that's where the part's going to fail. So airplane parts are made of much more stringent manufacturing conditions than, say, automobile parts, which are not meeting, 600 mile an hour stress, etc., and have to last for a million miles before they're replaced. But in outer space, you take a sheet of aluminum, for example. You go to the kitchen, you take out of the kitchen drawer the aluminum foil. It's very thin, it's pure aluminum. and it's fairly weak. You can rip it off with the, you know, the little perforated edge on the box. You pull that, and it pulls off a sheet of aluminum, and then you put it in a baking pan or cover food with it or something. Yeah, and it's flexible, etc. If you made that same sheet of aluminum foil in outer space, it would be stronger than steel. And the reason is, and by the way, there's about a 3-to-1 ratio between weight and strength. And so it would take, even though aluminum is stronger for its weight, it would take about 3 times as much aluminum to give you the strength of steel. But now if you produced the aluminum in outer space where there were no impurities mixed into the metal, and these impurities come, as I said, as the liquid metal is being heated up, and then it's in the smelter, and then it is cooled down. It's in being exposed to the atmosphere, and the oxygen, other contaminants get into the metal and cause it to weaken, because the aluminum is not bonding with aluminum, it's bonding with other things in the middle. So if you made that same sheet of aluminum foil out in outer space, it would be as strong as a piece of steel. So clearly there are some manufacturing uses for something that's extremely lightweight, very thin, and has the strength of steel. So once you get into outer space and manufacturing products in outer space, especially the living quarters, the other, the modules, the arms, the levers, the infrastructure, the frames, the ribbing, etc., of a object in outer space, like a space station, then the use of manufacturing in outer space has definite advantages. Okay. So I've talked about the carbon fiber. I've talked about the 3D printing, and then metallurgy in outer space. And there are some other things. For example, you may not know it. This is part of my comet work in the plasma discharge comet model, and also the diamond principle, which is an interesting aspect of understanding space travel, etc., but also calculate primes. I talk about this in that book. So this idea of diamonds comes out of a few different places, not to mention archaeology. And what happens in a vacuum, if you take pure carbon block and you gasify it, you turn it into a gas in a vacuum chamber and introduce an electron beam, what happens is it organizes the carbon atoms into a crystalline form, in other words, diamonds. You can make diamonds in using this technique and grow diamonds in a vacuum. And so there are fields, for example, in archaeology, the mastodons, which they discovered along the riverbeds that were washed into the river banks by tremendous flooding, which was the great catastrophe that killed them all, the Venus event. But also very interesting is that the upper side of the animals, some of them still with the skin and fur on, are peppered with micro diamonds. And so where did the micro diamonds come from? And only on the upper side. It means they came in from outer space and they made it all the way to the ground before they did not burn up in the atmosphere. So where did these come from? And the answer is, well, we had a raging comet nearby. And the comets in the nose side of the plasma discharge comet model are diamonds. There are diamond fields that have been observed around other stars, entire fields of diamonds discovered by spectroscopy. Anyway, so diamonds, a very, very hard material that could be used for cutting. A diamond is used on the most expensive cutting blades for metallurgy, for other like dental tools will have diamonds, or abrasive material will have diamonds when you're dealing with very hard materials. So another aspect of manufacturing in outer space is creating products that are extremely difficult to manufacture in Earth's atmosphere. And it also brings in the question, the concept, well, where do diamonds come from? The standard concept is that they were formed deep in Earth's, down deep in the Earth's below the surface, and then through very high pressure, they were formed. But that explanation doesn't make any sense, because how could softer material around the diamond, way down there in the ground, put more pressure on the diamond than the diamond itself? It doesn't make any sense at all. And then also the diamonds, then they say, come up through lava chutes and are in very specific areas. And so my read on it is that that is just completely bonkers, that explanation. And I suppose it has to work for the people that control the diamond industry, one of the more controlled industries on the planet, like emeralds or like other commodities, oil, not the least of which. But anyway, getting back to the idea that a lot of this manufacturing, say, of very specialized materials can happen in outer space. And it just turns out that also carbon is a very available material in outer space. We know this because in the plasma discharge comet model, drawing in materials, one of the main materials you find is, of course, water, H2O, so hydrogen and oxygen. So we're in a region of the entire solar system. You can see the water tail on comet. And then also the hydrogen, the carbon-hydrogen compounds and the hydrocarbons and the nitrogen-hydrogen compounds. So hydrogen mixing with nitrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Okay, so this has been this is in the ongoing series of Electric Highways to the Stars. And what does all of this have to do with Electric Highways to the Stars? Well, it's like, this is how you would make your spacecraft. So I'm going through some of the manufacturing processes that are in existence today to make vehicles, very lightweight vehicles. And of course, when you're dealing with electromagnetic propulsion, very lightweight craft are essential. And you know what I also think is rather comical is here you are, your general public out there, a lot of fans that have listened to me for decades and following me, and you're getting more education here than you would get if you took an aerospace engineering course at the university, because they don't teach this. They teach, they teach the standard stuff. You would probably learn about rockets, but none of this other stuff would be included. Materials, I shouldn't say that. That's a little bit harsh. But you would not learn at this composite level, putting all of these things together to have a space program which was based on autonomous space stations, etc., and then also clearly the concept of electric highways to the star. You would not see or touch that in a university anyplace. So you're getting a royal view into the reality, the real outer space, whereas you would not get that in a university setting, even if you were in graduate school at a higher level of engineering. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. Next week I'll be picking up this same topic again. It's really extensive, so you can see that every show I take you off into some esoteric branch of this entire concept of building spacecraft to go into outer space and ride the electric rivers to the stars. That's your birthright, by the way, and a lot of people are trying to take that away from you. You have politicians who are diverting your attention to all kinds of other issues when the real issue, there's two very simple issues when it comes to just living. One is living on this planet with the resources that are here and using them widely and being a good guardian to planet Earth and the human species. And the second one is your birthright to the stars, which, boy, they don't want you to even touch with a 10-foot pole. In fact, I just heard Richard Branson's getting a lot of flack from the FAA, because which brings up a question, too. Does the FAA have control over the airspace over New Mexico, which was the question. And apparently they dropped down a little bit below their flight plan, and then the FAA publicly accused them of being out of their flight plan, in other words, going out of the physical boundary, east, west, north, south, not the vertical boundary, but the lateral boundary of their flight plan, and claiming that it was causing danger. And so anyway, well, that's a whole nother issue. But the real question is, does the FAA have jurisdiction over New Mexico airspace? And I think that's something they should really look into, because the federal government does not have jurisdiction over New Mexico or any other state in any respect that isn't provided in the Constitution. And I dare say that in the Constitution, the framers were not probably thinking about airspace or control of that. They were thinking about, in general, that the states have control over everything regarding the state, except for those things specifically designated to the federal government. And I dare say airspace was not one of them. Okay, just a quick reminder, the coupon code that you can use for listeners to my show, go to the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com, and you can get a discount when you purchase any products there, including the whole house water filter, the MR5, and the optional UV filter. Highly recommended. My coupon code, by the way, before I forget, is JMCC. Four letters, JMCC, my initials, which is, you can kind of see all over the place, the webpage JMCC Water Filters, that's water filters plural, .com. Go there, buy your water filtration products, the best ones on the planet. You will not, I guarantee you, you will not find anything like these anyplace. And the webpage will explain it all. I'm not going to repeat that on the air here. But get yourself an MR5 filter. Everybody else is getting it. And we do have them in stock now. For most of the summer, we were behind on orders 20, 30, 45 days. And now we have them in stock ready to ship because of great effort that I've gone to get them in stock and be ahead of the orders. Good grief, that's been absolutely crazy bonkers. But we're there now, so we have these in stock. So get them while they're hot. Get them while they're on the shelf, because pretty soon other forms of marketing are going to kick in, and you're going to wish then that you had purchased it when there wasn't such a long lead time. But like I say, they're on the shelf now, ready to ship. So order now and get your discount, JMCC coupon code at checkout, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. And I'm out of time. We'll see you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.